Gaza. There are Palestinians there. It's like I get. It's sort of dangerous. I think that's the feeling I get.
What makes you feel like it's remote? What brings up that thought that it's dangerous?
On the news, I guess I just hear things, and I get the feeling it's not so safe.
In the middle of July 2019, producer Asaf Calderon and I went to the Upper West Side of Manhattan. We stood right outside of the Jewish Community Center asking people about their thoughts when it comes to Gaza, what they know and how they feel about what goes on there. Just like today, it was a few months after Israel and Hamas exchanged airstrikes and rocket fire.
The leadership says, okay, we have peace, but then there's a million factions just shoot off rockets. And on any different day, it's this organization and the liberation of that organization. You know, they make up these names and it doesn't really matter. Who's funding it? That's a good question. You know, is Iran behind a lot of it? I'm sure they're in the mix.
Do you have any particular feelings when you think about Gaza?
Well, I do because my friend's sons serve in the IDF. So I do worry about them. But I think it's pretty desperate, and I think something needs to be done.
What could be done?
I don't know. That's for other people.
The Gaza Strip has been under Israeli siege for 14 years, with cycles of violence happening over and over again. In the latest round of fighting, at least 254 Palestinians and 13 Israelis died. Israel has a new prime minister now, but on all accounts, Naftali Bennett seems intent on maintaining a similar show of force as Benjamin Netanyahu, if not more severe. 2 million people live in the Gaza Strip, and they've endured over a decade of air raids and an economic blockade that deprives them of basic necessities like power and clean water. But you'd hardly know that from conversations in the Jewish community that tend to focus only on Hamas terrorism and claims of widespread anti-Semitism. On today's episode of Unsettled, we hear from someone whose experiences inside the Gaza Strip tell a very different story. I'm Alana Levinson, and you're listening to Unsettled. This episode of Unsettled is a conversation with Kathleen Paradis, recorded in 2019 while we were producing our four-part series on Gaza. Make sure to check that out if you haven't heard it yet. Kathleen has worn many hats in her career. She's currently a partner at an employment justice law firm in Manhattan. She's the co-chair of the Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch, and she's the former director of the Women's Rights Project at the American Civil Liberties Union, succeeding Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Zichrona Livracha. Kathleen was also a founding board member of J Street, the liberal pro-Israel lobbying group. That was before she was ousted after she visited Gaza and met with Hamas officials while she was there. We'll get there. When we spoke to Kathleen, she'd been to Gaza a total of 5 times between 2011 and 2015, and she's written extensively about those experiences for The Nation, The Daily Beast, and The Forward. If that sounds a little scary to you, it's probably because of all the fear-mongering that's out there about what might happen to an outsider who visits the Gaza Strip. Kathleen's experiences as a Jewish woman visiting the Gaza Strip break right through those stereotypes. Here's my conversation with Kathleen Paradis. Why did you go in the first place? What was the intent in going, witnessing, and did you go hoping to bring something back to the American Jewish community based on something you were noticing about how the Jewish community was talking about Gaza?
Well, how the Jewish community is talking about Gaza is that there are a bunch of people with suicide belts. The stereotype of Palestinians in Gaza couldn't be more negative. And even suffering victims are thought to sort of deserve it, because if they voted for Hamas, then they deserve what they get. So the public perception of Americans and American Jews could hardly be lower. But I was interested in hearing what the officials had to say, what people had to say. After episodes of bombing, I wanted to see how bad it was and how people were coping. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to get stories and tell them. Mm-hmm. I remember several people that I spoke to in Gaza, ordinary people, said they had never talked to a Jew before who wasn't a soldier or a policeman. And that obviously makes them think that we're all a bunch of monsters. Mm. So the stereotypes go both ways.
Right. I
I every single time I think I've had these kinds of conversations about the West Bank or Gaza, I hear, oh, well, you should go to Gaza. They'll kill you there.
Well, the interesting thing that I experienced the first time I went was that I was as safe as a baby in a crib. There was no way any harm was going to come to me. Having an American journalist there to talk to them and see what they were about was something that they were very happy about and very generous with me about. I had one experience, I think I wrote about it, spending an hour and a half in a room with Hamas officials and having them ask me questions about the American Jewish community. That was just an extraordinarily thrilling conversation. I remember asking them, I said, what proportion of American Jews do you think have Israel in their top three issues that they care about? And they said 95%. And I said, I think it was 5%, or maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less. When I said that the proportion of American Jews who have Israel in their top three of public policy issues, they were shocked because they thought all of us were like the soldiers and politicians who have screwed them. They really ascribe that to all of us. So they were surprised that there are ordinary Jews who aren't preoccupied with killing them.
That trip that you took to Gaza, the one that you met with Hamas officials, can you talk about that trip? What sort of led you to it? And could you describe it?
Well, I think that you're talking about the time that I went into the tunnels. Every time I went to Gaza, I met with Hamas officials because that's who's in charge of Gaza. I met with government ministers and parliamentarians. But when you go to Gaza and you're talking to officials, you're talking to Hamas officials by and large. It was scary. It was at night. There were lots of tunnels at that time. There was a lot of commerce between Gaza and Egypt through the tunnels. And it wasn't just illicit stuff, it was everything. It was trucks and cars and all kinds of goods and agricultural products and manufactured products. The tunnels were all covered or mostly covered with big white tents, some kind of effort, I think, to conceal them, which was ridiculous because they weren't concealed at all. They were very open reality. So my British journalist friend that I went with had some familiarity with some of the people, and but he was also a little freaked out because it was night and there were a lot of people he didn't know. There was a fence into the tunnel area, and my friend and I went up to the fence and the gate, and this big guy said he wanted our passports. And my friend said, okay, and I gave him my passport, and I didn't know what in the world I was getting in for. But we obviously turned out to be safe. Nothing bad happened. And he showed us all kinds of tunnels that all kinds of different things went through. And one of the tunnels, which was a gigantic tunnel for big trucks, he asked if we wanted to walk through it because it wasn't very far to Egypt. My friend didn't want to do it, but I did. I thought I'll never be here again, and I wanted to see what that was like. So it was scary, but as with a lot of scary things, after a period of time goes by and you sort of assess that you're not in danger, that fear sort of dissipates, which it did. And I was talking with them and chatting with them. I told them who I was, that I was an American journalist, a Jewish American journalist. And they were very interested to hear why I was there and what I was going to say.
And why were you scared? What made those tunnels so scary?
Because it was dark. It was a lot of people that I didn't know and who have, in general, a bad reputation. The tunnels are formally illegal. There was certainly a lot of controversy about them, and I was just stepping into something where I didn't know what I was stepping into.
You described in one of your pieces that the meeting with the Hamas officials was comfortable and chutzpahdik. Can you talk about that, what you mean by the level of comfort and chutzpahdik of that meeting?
what I remember is that my fear sort of melted away, and it felt kind of like an alternate universe that an American Jewish woman is in a tunnel in Gaza talking to a big Gaza enforcer, a big Hamas enforcer. So it was exciting and a little scary and very informative, because when you look people in the eye, you learn things and you get an idea of things that you don't get when you just read stories in the paper.
Do you remember some of those things that you learned?
Well, I remember that we were talking about how this was the only way for Gaza to get goods, because the blockade on the Israel border was just complete. And during that period of time, it looked as if Gaza was going to be turning to Egypt for all things, for political alliances. It was the only way for Palestinians in Gaza to actually get out of Gaza. To go out of Gaza, it was the window on the world for Palestinians from Gaza, because they couldn't go through Rafah. And Egypt was allowing it. Morsi was in power. And it looked like Gaza had a bright future, that there was going to be a loosening of the stranglehold. So looking west rather than east looked like a strategy that was going to work. So there was a lot of hope. And there was a lot of activity, and there was, you know, you could get building materials, you could get food, I'm sure you could get guns, I'm sure that lots of bad stuff came through also. But it was a period when Palestinians in Gaza were feeling that they weren't totally trapped, because there was a window and a door.
Mm. So after that trip, you received a considerable amount of blowback from J Street. Would you mind telling us a bit about that, what happened, and were you expecting that?
Well, it had been building. I had gone to Gaza a couple of times and gotten some pushback from the leadership at J Street. And they pushed and I pushed. And finally, in the last analysis, the executive committee was unified in telling me that I had to either stop going to Gaza or quit the executive committee. And that was not a very hard choice for me. So I quit. Because if I hadn't quit, I would have been fired. But I wasn't going to promise to stop going to Gaza or to stop going anywhere or to stop writing about anything in particular.
So to me, that sort of says that there was a clear kind of choice made about this idea of hard lines around talking to people like Hamas officials and being accepted on a board of this kind of organization. Is that true? Did it feel like that kind of choice for you?
Well, I think to be fair, what J Street was worried about, struggling for acceptance itself, it's much more mainstream, much more accepted as mainstream now than it was then. J Street was worried about headlines that said J Street meets Hamas. So I knew that that was the sensitivity. What I would have hoped is that J Street would have been able to say, she's wearing a different hat. She's a journalist. She gets to do what she wants as a journalist, as do all of the people on the board or the executive committee. They've got their own jobs. She's not speaking for J Street, and that's that. But they didn't do that. So I was disappointed in that. I understood it, but I thought it was a bad decision.
So we've been doing this series on Gaza, mm-hmm. Specifically since the Great March of Return. Mm-hmm. We realized that we hadn't done any content. We'd been doing this thing for a year and change, and we hadn't done any content on Gaza. We hadn't told stories about Gaza. And when we thought about why as a team, we realized there was some internal anxiety around talking about Gaza. We talk about the West Bank all the time, and what we do is dig into difficult conversations. That's what we say we're about. So, you know, we had this kind of conversation. Well, what is it? Why aren't we talking about Gaza? And you know, we thought about how it feels even harder to talk about Gaza in the American Jewish community than it is to talk about the West Bank. Do you feel that as well?
I think it's absolutely true. And I think there are a few reasons why that's true. I think, first of all, there's really an assumption that Palestinians in Gaza are all a bunch of violent, Hamas-supporting, gun-toting, bomb-throwing lunatics. Either that, or they, as I said before, they got what they deserved by voting for Hamas in the first place. So I think that's a bunch of stereotypes that people have. People say, we marched out of Gaza and they destroyed everything. You know, that narrative, people really believe it. But it's so closed and so hard to get into that it's very difficult to get all the stories that you can easily get in the West Bank. You can go talk to all kinds of people, but it's not at all easy to do that when it comes to Gaza.
You talk about the stereotype of the gun-toting, violent, yeah, Hamasnik, yeah, that tends to paint all of Gaza, all Gazans. How did your meeting with Hamas officials and people who live in Gaza sort of dispel that narrative?
Well, the gun-toting narrative just isn't true. I think that one thing that is more complicated and more nuanced among Hamas officials is the extent to which they are tractable. And in those years, there were a number of people, and some of them I spoke to and quoted in my pieces, they were willing to talk about a 25-year truce, a 25-year Hudna, which seemed like a pretty good thing to have as an offer on the table to actually talk about. So although formally everybody thinks that Israel should be destroyed, and they will say so, as a practical matter, they were prepared to deal in a much more nuanced way. And I don't know if that's true anymore or not. I just don't know, because I haven't talked to them for a long time.
So since the trip that inspired the J Street condemnation, if you would characterize it that way.
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay. Since that trip, has your activism and thoughts about Gaza changed?
Not at all as a result of J Street or any of that. I've been interested in these issues and an activist on these issues since the late 80s, and I just continue to be so. I think that my hope for figuring out anything that Zionism means that I could support gets harder and harder. Trying to figure out how there could possibly be a Jewish state that we could be comfortable with, that's something that you grapple with over time. And there's no view of a Jewish state that I've heard anybody articulate lately that seems like something that I can be enthusiastic about. Mm. 50 years ago, 70 years ago, there were articulations that we could be thrilled about, but today I don't know.
Mm. Yeah, you're reminding me that 25 or 35 years ago, I was a liberal Zionist, anti-BDS, pro-Oslo, pro-two-state solution, hopeful person. 50 years later, I couldn't say any of those things.
Why is that? What happened?
Well, all reality happened. We see that there is not, that the two-state solution had fatal flaws built in from the beginning that most of us didn't see. Some people saw it, but most people didn't see it. And the situation for Palestinians has gotten worse and worse. Justice has been sundered. Fairness doesn't exist. And that's what's happened.
Mm. And how do you think that's reflected in the conversation and actions in the American Jewish community around Gaza specifically?
Well, I think it's all very generational. I think that young people tend to understand that ethno-nationalism is the problem. Older people don't see Israel as an ethno-nationalist state, but I think younger people do. And ethno-nationalism here, Nazis, neo-fascists, Likud party members, it's all of a piece. And ethno-nationalism is something that we have to grapple with.
And what do you mean when you say ethno-nationalism?
Well, I think that the idea of a state that is not just a nation, it's not nationalism, it's the ethno part of it that's the problem. Being a nationalist and wanting everybody to be part of this national enterprise, that may have problems and limitations, but when the nationalist idea is limited to part of the polity, that is that's fascism, that's injustice, that's racism, that's all the stuff that we don't like and we've been fighting against all of our lives. But we have a blind spot when it comes to Israel. And I think young people, many young people are beginning to, or have not been seduced by romanticism that seduced their parents for decades.
So we spoke to a refugee family. We spoke to a organizer of the Great March of Return and his father, who was expelled from Palestine in 1948.
Where?
He was from a village called Sarafand el-Amar.
Inside the Green Line?
Yes. Yes. Near Lida.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, they were quite clear. They were like, we have to go back. You know, this place is too small for us. We can't all live here. So to me, when I hear you talk about ethno-nationalism and I think about them, I sort of think, well, that's the part, like our commitment to ethno-nationalism is what makes that idea that millions of Gazans living in this place.
Don't say Gazans, Palestinians from Gaza.
Tell me why.
Because it's one people. We have to resist the idea that people from Gaza, Palestinians from Gaza, are a different tribe from Palestinians elsewhere. I was corrected on that when I was writing these pieces by Palestinians who said, don't call them Gazans, they're Palestinians.
Yeah, I never thought about it like that. Yeah, so I guess what I'm trying to ask is, you know, do you think ethno-nationalism is the problem when we talk? You know, we tend to avoid these conversations about return, this demand from Palestinians from Gaza to return. Do you see the American Jewish community's refusal to even entertain that idea as a result of this commitment to ethno-nationalism or something else?
Well, I think it's a result of the commitment to a Jewish majority state. And the number of people in Gaza screws up everybody's assessment of our demographic superiority. I've heard settler-type people, and you've probably heard them too, talk about actually giving Palestinians in the West Bank rights, even equal rights. They tend to be ultra-Orthodox, and they think they are going to win the demographic war, because they have 8 or 9 or 10 kids, and Palestinians have 2 or 3. But if you include Gaza in that assessment, then they don't have a chance, because the 2 million plus in Gaza mean that Palestinians have the demographic edge. So that Gaza mixes up a lot of people's analyses. But I think, yeah, the reason that we engage in this ethnic cleansing, even if it's not killing people, but it's getting them to leave one way or another through a million techniques and not letting Palestinians from Gaza in, or Arabs from anywhere. We don't let in Arabs from anywhere. That is to maintain a Jewish majority. There's nothing secret about that. You know, I don't think the attitudes of the mainstream or even liberal American Jewish community about Gaza is based on their lack of information. Information is available. Information is not secret. It's not hard to find. I think that there's a very strong, visceral, maybe romantic, but I don't want to denigrate it by calling it romantic, but a very visceral attachment to the classical Zionist dream and idea. I belong to a Rosh Chodesh group of very brainy, smart, intellectual, liberal women, professors and writers and speakers and activists. And I asked them in a group I facilitated a couple of months ago. I mean, the question I put on the table to talk about is anti-Zionism, anti-Semitism? And to me, that's really the very kernel of this ethno-nationalist issue. And we talked about it, and they were resisting the idea that you could be anti-Zionist and not be anti-Semitic. And I ask them, just assume for a minute that there will never be a Palestinian state, which I happen to believe. My Palestinian friends, some of them are very annoyed with that belief, but it's my belief that there will not be a Palestinian state. However, there are 6 million Palestinians from the river to the sea, maybe 7. What do we do with them? So I ask these women, assume there's not going to be a Palestinian state. What do we do with 7 million Palestinians? Some of them said, holy cow, I never thought of it that way. What do we do with them? What do we do? That really focuses the issue of a Jewish majority state or not. What are you going to do, shoot them? Or permanently deprive them of civil rights or political rights? To me, the answer is pretty easy. You can't deprive them of political rights forever. And you can't shoot them, and you can't expel them. So the result is rights and equal rights and all that that implies.
What kind of power do you think there is in the American Jewish community when it comes to Gaza?
I think there is power, but there's not the will. I think there will be power and the will as a younger generation starts taking over.
After the latest round of fighting between Hamas and Israel this year, and a newly invigorated and unified Palestinian protest movement, many have noticed a change in attitude among Jews toward Israeli aggression. And yet, major Jewish organizations remain silent about Palestinian rights. In May of 2021, the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations issued a statement calling on the international community to, quote, raise its voice against the outrageous ongoing rocket attacks and acts of violence deliberately targeting Israeli civilians. The statement commends the Israeli Defense Forces and calls the Gaza Strip, quote, another front for the extremist Iranian regime, without any mention of Palestinian life and communities destroyed as a result of the fighting. A similar statement from the Jewish Federations of North America offers prayers for the fighting to end, but points to a, quote, spike in anti-Israel misinformation, anti-Semitic diatribes on social media, and offers links to resources on advocating for Israel and urging President Biden to take concrete steps against anti-Semitism. Again, no mention of Palestinians. To learn more about Kathleen's visits to the Gaza Strip and what she saw and learned while she was there, we've provided a list of her articles in the show notes and on our website, unsettledpod.com. You'll also find links in the show notes to our 4-part series on Gaza, which goes into depth about Hamas, Palestinian refugees, the energy crisis, and the Great March of Return. Unsettled is produced by Emily Bell, Max Friedman, Asaf Calderon, and me, Alana Levinson. If you like this episode of Unsettled, we'd love for you to leave us a review and a rating on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, be sure to hit subscribe.